Batman and Metamorpho. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Batman and Metamorpho from The Brave and the Bold, number 68, cover dated November 1966. Well, this is a really old and a goofy one, I think.
Yeah, this is during the months that DC realized the hit they had with the Batman television series and were leaning into the trappings of that series for sure.
In fact, the inside front cover is an ad for the Batman 66 movie.
Oh, okay, okay.
For the first time on the motion picture screen in color.
Awesome.
Yeah, there's definitely a link between that movie and what's happening in this issue in terms of the villains, etc. But still, Metamorpho is our guest star, so we should preface with reasons or why we like the guest character. What's so great about Metamorpho?
Well, I think he's got a very unique look for one. He looks like a villain, really. He's self-deprecating on one hand, but quite confident on the other. He's basically DC's version of Ben Grimm with a better sense of humor. Of course, we sympathize with him because most of us readers feel a bit like outcasts, so that helps. He's got a great supporting cast in Sapphire, his love interest, and Simon Stagg, her father, and Java, the Neanderthal bodyguard that Rex found and Simon gave intelligence to. Plus, visually, he just looks striking. The fact he can morph his body into any elemental combination is just cool. And I actually first met him in another Brave and the Bold, number 154, when I was like only 4 years old. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I think I'll co-sign all of that. I don't really have anything more to add. I think that's the package. And I think DC, in terms of the look, DC always did themselves a disservice when they changed it. Like make it more monstrous or more complicated. Mm-hmm. Like the textures, I think he's perfect as he is or as he was when he was created.
Agreed.
Let's talk about his publication history.
I did try to restrain myself a little bit this time.
we'll see how well you did.
Sing it with me, folks. This is the story of the Element Man. Metamorpho.
Okay.
Yeah. Metamorpho's creation is credited to writer Bob Haney, more on him later, and artist Ramona Fraiden. But in a 2013 interview with Comic Book Resources, the late Mrs. Fraiden gave credit for the initial idea to their editor, George Cashton. Fraiden said Metamorpho was George Cashton's idea. He had studied science when he was in school, and he thought of a character made of four elements who could change himself into different chemical compounds. He gave Bob Haney the idea, and Bob fleshed it out brilliantly. I believe George continued to supply the scientific details for Bob to use throughout the life of the feature. Bob, George, and I got together to figure out what the character should look like. He wasn't your average superhero, so capes and masks didn't suit him. I tried a lot of those and finally decided that since he was always changing his shape, clothes would get in his way. So I drew him in tights with a body made up of four different colors and textures that were supposed to indicate the four elements. This is Chris again. Metamorpho debuted in The Brave and the Bold, number 57, January 1964. Famous soldier of fortune Rex Mason was sent on a mission by his frequent employer, genius billionaire Simon Stagg, to steal the powerful Orb of Ra from the lost Egyptian pyramid of Akhtun, baby. Unbeknownst to Rex, the mission was set up to trap and kill Mason in the tomb, since Stagg didn't approve of Rex's engagement to his beloved daughter, Sapphire. Rex is left for dead by Stagg's Neanderthal bodyguard, Java, who steals the orb. While trapped, Rex is exposed to the radiation of the meteor the orb was created from. The strange energies alter Mason's physical appearance and allow him control over all chemical elements, including the ability to morph his disfigured body into various combinations of them. Rex confronts Stagg, who uses the Orb of Ra to weaken his powers. Stagg offers to help find a cure for Rex, who forever laments his new, freakish appearance. Sapphire, who still loves him, encourages Rex to use his powers as a force for good. Despite their truce and his promise to cure him, Simon Stagg constantly plots against Rex, who now goes by the name Metamorpho. Editor Cashton, writer Haney, artist Fraiden, and inker Charles Paris parodied standard superhero comics while also evoking the pathos and countercultural aspects of the increasingly popular Marvel Comics brand of superheroes such as Ben Grimm, a.k.a. The Thing. Although Rex seemed to have a better attitude toward his outward freakiness. Maybe it's because he could cover up his face with a patented lifelike rubber mask and still look like his old self? Metamorpho appeared again in Brave and the Bold number 58, then graduated to his own initially very popular title, Metamorpho, beginning with a July-August 1965 cover date. Fraiden exited the book and comics for a time to raise her family with issue number 4. Joe Orlando, Sal Trapini, and Jack Sparling drew the remainder of the series. Rex is invited to join the JLA in Justice League of America number 44, but famously, Metamorpho says no. He does, however, become a reserve member. He returns to B&B, teaming up with the similarly wacky Metal Men in issue number 66, June-July 1966, then, of course, 2 issues later, the story we're about to cover. During the height of his popularity, in the superhero boom of 1966, a series of Metamorpho animated shorts was in development by Filmation as a potential addition to their Superman Aquaman Hour of Adventure show. There was even ads in DC Comics announcing this. Unfortunately, Rex never made the cut alongside other characters like Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, Atom, and the Teen Titans. The potential TV deal is probably why Metamorpho got his own theme song, which you kind of heard before, and audio adventure on the Songs and Stories of the Justice League of America album, originally issued by Tifton Records in 1966. Rex even got his own single release with a die-cut cover. A Metamorpho was canceled with issue number 17, March-April 1968. Haney wrote every appearance of his co-creation, except, I guess, when he was in Justice League. That was Gardner Fox. Rex went into limbo for several years, but 1972 was a very big year for him. He reappeared in Brave and the Bold number 101, written once again by Haney. He joined the JLA for issues 100 through 102 of the title, helping in the quest to rescue the time-lost Seven Soldiers of Victory. He got his own backup series in Action Comics, running from issues 412 through 418, and then hopped over for a run in World's Finest with issues 217 through 229, some of which were team-ups with Superman and Batman. All of these were written by Haney. Haney reunited with Ramona Fraiden for a one-shot revival of the original series with first issue special number 3, June 1975, but unfortunately a new ongoing title did not result from the experiment. Rex went mostly inert for the rest of the decade into the early 80s, only appearing in a couple of B&Bs and one DC Comics Presents issue. It's fitting that he got his true second lease on life in the final issue of The Brave and the Bold number 200, July 1983, when he debuted as a member of Batman's new super team, The Outsiders. Batman and The Outsiders debuted in earnest the following month, with Rex as one of the veteran members alongside a group of new heroes created by Mike W. Barr and Jim Aparo. Rex stayed with The Outsiders through their move to Los Angeles in their own direct-only Baxter title, The Outsiders. Along the way, he and Sapphire are finally married. When the title is canceled amidst the much-beloved Millennium crossover with issue number 27, January 1988, Rex is killed by the team's ally Dr. Jace, who is revealed to be a Manhunter. And no man escapes the Manhunter, even Element Man. Another intercompany crossover brings Rex back when the Dominator's gene bomb revives Rex during the invasion event. This time he says yes, and becomes a card-carrying member of the Justice League International with issue number 24, February 1989, and moves to the European branch with Justice League Europe number 1, April 1989. Of course, Shag covered all of those on his Wahaha podcast. During the course of the series, it's revealed that Sapphire gave birth to Rex's child shortly after he died. She also married Java, but Rex's son, Baby Joey, was born looking much like his father with out-of-control elemental powers. Only Rex, Sapphire, and Simon could touch him without horrific results, such as him melting Java's arms off. Rex got his own title back, briefly in the form of a 1993 miniseries written by Mark Waid with art by Graham Nolan. Rex nearly dies again and reforms with a new, more extreme look in the retitled Justice League International number 62, March 1994. After the events of Zero Hour, 90s Rex moves over to the Justice League America title.
The handover to the so-called real Justice League, Grant Morrison's JLA, isn't kind to Metamorpho. He is killed in that first issue, but of course, he's brought back to life. And he briefly joins the Doom Patrol in 2002 during John Arcudi's run. He'll also be a supporting player in John Byrne's Doom Patrol series 3 years later. But before that, in 2004, he seems to rejoin the Outsiders. But then it's explained, you're going to love this, this was just a fragment of the original Metamorpho with its own separate consciousness. The real Rex decides to let it live and continues on with the team under the codename Shift. Shift is reassimilated into the original Metamorpho after the events of 1 year later as penance for having killed some people. And Rex rejoins the Outsiders, soon back under Batman's leadership. And that storyline ends in 2007 with Metamorpho being blown to smithereens by Talia al Ghul in Batman and the Outsiders Volume 2, Number 12. In the New 52, his story apparently continues without a reboot, and he survived the explosion as revealed in Batman Incorporated. He's on Booster Gold's list for the new Justice League International, but he isn't chosen. And since Rebirth, however, Metamorpho has enjoyed a lot more play. He explored the Dark Multiverse as a member of the Terrifics in 2018. Doomsday Clock screwed around with his origin, that would prove temporary. He appears fairly frequently in the new World's Finest, featuring flashback stories to Superman and Batman's early partnership, and has participated in various events as a JLA reservist, including Batman Santa Claus Silent Night Returns last year. But the most high-profile thing he's been in is 2025's Superman movie, played by Anthony Carrigan, which seems to have given him an extra boost in the comics. He's been a guest star in several books, from Shazam to JSA, in addition to Justice League Unlimited, also its connective miniseries. And he's had his own very cool 6-issue series called Metamorpho, The Element Man, by Al Ewing and Steve Lieber. I really enjoyed that. Hope there's going to be a follow-up. But Metamorpho, every so often, they sort of tease him in other media, and then it sort of gives him a little kick, a little boost in the comics themselves. So he's always around.
Yeah, pulling himself back together and coming back. Yeah, basically.
Right, he's kind of the hero you can kill, because like Kemo or these characters who aren't made of flesh, like Sandman or Hydro Man, they're sort of like recomposite themselves at some point and you can have them back.
There was a 2-part episode of Justice League, the animated Justice League, pre-Justice League Unlimited, called Metamorphosis, with Tom Sizemore voicing Rex. And that's an interesting take on him. And really, of course, Cindy and I covered that on our JLU cast. Really seedy version of Simon Stagg, where they lean into his obsession with his daughter. It's really creepy. Just like very unsavory. He's like, ah.
And I'm glad that latest miniseries, which is very Haney-esque, almost a spoof of those 60s comics, you just brought it back to the original origin. Because like Doomsday Clock decided, oh no, this is all a cover. It's not real. The whole Orb of Ra is just like a cover story. And really, Simon Stagg is working for some sort of super soldier project. And Metamorph Rex was like experimented on. And then they did away with all that. It's just like, why change that origin? I don't even know why you would change him from sort of like modern day Indiana Jones to, oh, just another government project. Ugh.
Yeah.
We've had enough of those, you know.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Firestorm didn't get that. They kept that part of his origin intact, I guess, in this new series. So yeah.
Yes, the latest miniseries has Professor Stein being like one of those super soldier makers from the Doomsday Clock ideas. It's not a bad miniseries to date, but
yeah,
why do we need to taint our heroes with that kind of... I get it if you were doing like a movie and you wanted like a new origin that was more steeped into the current government paranoia type stuff.
Yeah.
But why change the origin of a hero that's been well established for forever to fit that in? Anyway.
Yeah.
That's besides the point. let's get into this one comic, which is, far earlier than any of the current material. I mean, 1966, that means we're at the 60th anniversary, basically, of this.
Yes. I mean, we hit it right up, almost pretty much right on the head, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, because if it's cover date in November, we're very close.
Yeah.
So it's called Alias the Bat Hulk. It's written by Bob Haney with art by Mike Sikowski. And I have it as Mike Esposito, but different sources give a different inker on this. Try to figure out if it's really Esposito or Murphy Anderson or what is it?
Joe Giella.
Yeah, I can't really tell from the art.
I feel like the interior is Esposito. It kind of has It kind of has a little bit of that Ross Andrew, Mike Esposito look from the Wonder Woman series of the time to me. The cover is Joe Giella, but I think Anderson modified Batman's face.
Oh, okay.
So Bat Hulk's face, yeah.
Went back and redid some faces.
Right, yeah.
Okay, interesting. That clears that up. Let's get into the synopsis for this. And as usual, we have Batman and our reliable narrator doing it. So,
greetings, citizens. This is Batman, here to tell you about one of the most bizarre cases from my bat crime files. was a night like any other, except Robin was off with the Teen Titans, so I went on patrol alone. I was surprised when that dastardly Prince of Puzzlers, the Riddler, appeared on the Batmobile's TV screen. I followed his cryptic clue to the diamond exchange and caught the felonious fiend mid-robbery. When he threw a diamond out the window, I grabbed it, only to have it explode in my hand, emitting a strange gas. The Riddler managed to escape, but I soon spied another of my arch foes, that fiendish fowl, the Penguin, flying through the Gotham sky. His taunting comments about carrier pigeons led me to the City Museum, where I caught up to him. He sprayed me with yet another strange gas from his umbrella and flew off into the night. Pondering why two of my arch foes were out to gas me, I began to hear the voice of that clown prince of crime, the Joker, coming from the gear shift of my Batmobile. The vile visage of that jeering jester had replaced the knob and was taunting me that he had booby-trapped the Batmobile. I pressed the button for the bat anti-booby-trap circuit, but instead of ejecting from the car, gas spewed from the vents. I began to laugh uncontrollably and crashed the Batmobile into a utility pole. Then a startling metamorphosis occurred, for I went from cowled crime fighter to Bat Hulk. I grabbed the pole and melted it with my bare, oversized hands. My mind altered just as my lumbering body, I stalked away, only to encounter Commissioner Gordon and some of his police. I am ashamed to admit that I hurled a flaming ball from my hands and destroyed their squad car. I continued on, causing untold amounts of damage to private property all across Fair Gotham. Later in the park, near a pond, I changed back to my old, upright self. I then deduced Riddler, Penguin, and the Joker had colluded to transform me into that rampaging monster. I figured there was only one person who might help me, so I made my way to the armed mansion of
Simon Stagg, the world's richest man and employer of one Metamorpho, the Element Man. Perhaps he can use his science skills to figure out what Batman's rogues did to him. Stagg has no antidote for him, but confirms Batman's antibodies are overrun by the chemical cocktail and that he could become the Bat-Hulk at any time. Batman asks Metamorpho to try and keep him under control if it happens again, and right then, it does. Rex tries to capture him in magnesium strands, but the Bat-Hulk melts them, then shows new powers, turning his hands into a mold that reshapes Rex's magnesium fingers into a replica of Rex himself that's thrown back at him. While Rex disentangles himself, the Bat-Hulk escapes.
As the malevolent malefactor, the Bat-Hulk, I crash the secret headquarters of my terrible trio of foes. Cowering like the reprobates they are, I inform them they would help me on a super crime wave. But then suddenly, I reverted to my old self. The fiends decided to use their strength in numbers to pummel me. But just as suddenly, I reverted once more to my monstrous alter ego. And this time I felt the change was permanent. I retrieved the flying bat cave and set about on a shameful crime spree. With Joker, Penguin, and Riddler aboard, I lowered myself onto the roof of a Gotham bank, blasted a hole through the roof, and absconded with bags and bags of cash. No doubt the savings of Gotham's thrifty, hardworking citizens. But then the police caught up to me, and their helicopters opened fire upon my flying apparatus.
Metamorpho confronts the Bat-Hulk on the rooftop, and while he avoids the creature's chemical batarangs, he still gets grabbed by its powerful hands and is squeezed into a long liquid filament of a man. Rejoining his supporting cast in this state, Rex is repowered by Java, who, at Stagg's direction, hits him with a live wire ripped from a transformer box. On another rooftop, Commissioner Gordon points to the Bat-Hulk by lighting a Bat-Hulk signal in the sky, and Rex and crew head to the indicated clock tower. But as the monster grabs the lightning rod on top to smash Rex with it, lightning strikes and knocks the Bat-Hulk out. Later, on the street, Gordon has arrested the three villains, and Metamorpho walks down with an unconscious and cured Batman on his shoulder. The bad guy's laughter awakens the Caped Crusader, and they're soon ferried away in a paddy wagon as the heroes shake hands and part ways. So that's the issue. we'll discuss it in full, but let's start where we always do. The cover. Mike Sekowski, Joe Giella on this particular one. The Bat-Hulk is squeezing Metamorpho like a toothpaste tube while the three villains from the movie, we're only missing Catwoman here, are laughing. Oh, nice work, Bat Hulk. Haha, bye-bye, Element Man. They're more like laughing at Metamorpho than they are Batman, who would be their normal enemy. Strange perspective, making it like really gonzo. What do you think of this one?
It definitely is a grabber. I mean, if you were a kid in 1966, you'd be like, why is Batman ginormous? Why is he grabbing Metamorpho? And the three villains, you know, obviously they were already three of the most popular villains on the TV series, and now they're in the movie. So I think you'd buy it. I like it. It's interesting because, like you said, in this comic, the villains never really interact with Metamorpho at all. So I like the perspective. It kind of feels a little Kirby-esque because there's so much force perspective going on. So, you know, if Metamorpho is a little bit of a Marvel character at DC, it kind of fits.
And Batman is being the Hulk. So there's a real Marvel vibe.
Obviously, yeah, we're going to get into that. Yeah, he is it. Yeah, the Bat Hulk. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like the fact that they're laughing at him and there's no speech bubbles. They're just like, do it as sound effects.
Yeah.
That doesn't like break up the cover. It doesn't like hide the art. It's like, so it's pretty cool. That big red brick wall makes Metamorpho pop. And he doesn't seem like particularly, I mean, he's being squeezed. And as in the story, it is hurtful, but he still has like fists out. And it feels more like a matchup that they're equal monsters.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It's kind of weird now that I look at it up close that Batman's thumbs aren't behind his body, because how's he really squeezing him like that without, you know, catching him between his thumb and forefinger, you know, index finger? I don't know, but, you know.
Almost more like he's catching him as he's kind of stretching away or something.
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah, with the palms of his hands, massive hands.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. They're the size of, I don't know what, they're humongous, so yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, giant mitts.
Yeah.
I guess big picture, do we want to talk about the Marvelization of this right away?
Right, sure, yeah. I think Haney and Arnold Drake over in the Doom Patrol and E. Nelson Bridwell with things like the Inferior Five, they were like the only creators at DC that really noticed that Marvel was taking off. I think some of the old stuffy, you know, DC office, you know, the writers and artists who wore a tie to work every day weren't paying attention to the fact that, you know, Spider-Man was coming over and mowing the grass. You know, those particular writers were, you know, Arnold Drake created I believe with a little help from Haney in the initial story, created the Doom Patrol, like, and was published the exact same month as the X-Men, you know?
Yeah.
So there was definitely, you know, wheelchair bound leader of a team of quote unquote misfit heroes, you know? It's amazing how that happened. It's like no, and nobody else, the upper crust of DC, the powers that be there, didn't seem to care or notice that the Marvel way of doing comics was starting to kind of make some of the DC comics look a little stale here. So yeah, obviously Haney's aware and he's leaning into not only the campy Batmania of the 60s TV series, but he, like we said, he uses the word Hulk, you know, which is not, you know, that that wasn't a real common thing. And Batman transforms into a monstrous giant creature. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the word Hulk is in the dictionary. It's maybe you can't, but making it like a superhero who transforms gets real big. There is like a ragged look to the costume, just like the Hulk when he transforms. So yeah, definitely like a swipe at Marvel. But also I'm thinking, obviously, I have like this fascination with Amalgam Comics. It's even part of this show. And I kind of wish, this isn't Haney's fault or anything, or this comic, but I wish they'd amalgamated Batman and the Hulk when they did the Amalgam Comics. It's not like Batman has anything in common with Wolverine or Nick Fury, which is what they paired him up with.
Mm-hmm.
And they really sidelined the Hulk in those comics. It was like as big a property. He was one of the big matchups. But then when you get into the Amalgam Comics themselves, he's paired with Solomon Grundy and he's very much like a supporting character. Mm. So if they'd done this, if they'd done like a Batman Hulk, it would have been a very cool reference to this, in my opinion, seminal 60s comic.
Look at the absolute Batman has essentially got the body of the Bat Hulk. And... and how popular that is. They missed a beat there, right? So
yeah. So yeah. Anyway, obviously I'm projecting to the 90s, you know, 30 years later. But in any case, this whole comic, you're talking about the camp, and obviously it's kind of promotional for the movie, especially given the trio of villains who are all very much themselves. You know, Riddler leaves a clue, Penguin commits a bird-related crime, Joker pranks Batman, and they each get their little piece, which I think is cool. I don't know if their plan to get Batman out of the way by turning him into a super strong monster who shoots balls of lava is necessarily a good plan. But it does also make him a criminal who participates in their crimes and then takes over their gang. So.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It's not the most foolproof plan that they've ever come up with, but they're insane. They're insane villains.
Right, and there's, of course, no explanation how they came up with this plan and knew that, you know, the gases would alter Batman, you know, if they all, you know, gassed him at various different intervals. And, you know, it's, I mean, I guess in some ways it kind of like the, you know, how the Joker will, two components of the Joker venom.
Smilex.
Right, yeah. The Smilex and, you know, that type of thing. It's kind of similar to that, but it's like, you know, and the Joker obviously has been, even in Batman 89, he has a proficiency in chemistry, but it's like, how, you know, the, and it is odd that Bat Hulk, I guess they wanted to tie it into more of a foe for Metamorpho, that he has these chemical powers,
right,
that he can, you know, shoot lava and form his hands into a mold to make a magnesium copy of Metamorpho. So.
Right. He keeps calling himself, or they call him, and then he starts to call himself the chemical phenom. I guess it is a play on Element Man to make him match. I think it would have worked better if they didn't do like fireballs, that it maybe like color it more like it, like acid, because that's how it works. Because fire doesn't, I mean, obviously flames are a chemical reaction, but at the same time, it feels like, okay, what can he do? And so I think if it were like balls of acid, which is how it works anyway in the comic, would have been, maybe it's not as dramatic to have like a bluish ball and a fiery red orange ball.
Yeah, and at one point he makes a fiery batarang, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yes. But the way that Haney is writing in this one, is a particular interest to me, because he's like doing like a first person, he's a third person narrator, but he's got a lot of personality, which is also kind of the Marvel style, Stan Lee, and you know, the voice of Stan Lee coming through, sort of thing. But it's like, Batman, don't go out into that night. You
know? Yeah.
It's like the narrator is warning Batman about this plan that the three villains have. And it keeps like, it's like a puppet show where he's like, no, look behind you, kind of. It's a very strange narration for a comic book. But at the same time, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like the narration on the Batman 66 TV series with the producer, William Dozier, doing his, what they call Desmond Doomsday, where he's like, you know, oh no, Cape Crusaders, don't walk into that trap, you know, that type of thing. You know, it's a little bit like that. And Haney actually kind of keeps that always to a point in a lot of his stories. But yeah, he's definitely up the ante in this one for sure.
Yeah. It even starts after the splash page. It starts like, I don't know, like a Dr. Seuss kind of nursery rhyme. This is Wayne Mansion, home of the most famous hero of them all. Okay, first panel. Second panel. This is the closet in the home of the most famous hero. This is the famous costume in the closet of the most famous hero. This is a secret door in the home of the, you know, it's like,
yeah.
He has a lot of fun with the narration. So as a writer, I enjoy Bob Haney. It's not just like, you know, very simple captions. He can't go meanwhile.
No.
He has to go like crazy.
He took his storytelling even though it's quite silly often, he took it very seriously, that he had to make every word that you read had to be entertaining, basically. And it is, you know, so that, I mean, we always got to give him credit for, aside from the zaniness and because of the zaniness, he was a very proficient wordsmith, that's for sure. And I do like that Bruce Wayne, you know, despite the fact that this is the period of the TV series, there's no bat poles. He keeps his Batman costume in a closet inside Wayne Manor, which is like very low rent for Batman, especially during this period, you know. So.
Wouldn't you just like keep it in the caves? And anyway, he has to go in the cave to take the car out.
Right.
But the reason to do it is that opener. This
right.
is the closet, and so, you know, he had that idea, so suddenly the costume is in the house.
Right.
Where probably in other stories it's not.
Yeah. It's like, you know, there's been some Batman stories where it's like, never wear any of the costume up into the house, you know. And of course, then they violate that. But yeah, so yeah, it's yeah, it is kind of funny to see Batman's rumpled costume. And I seem like I remember Sikowski drawing Bruce Wayne pulling his Batman costume out of a closet in a Justice League story where his JLA signal device went off. And of course, Mike Sikowski at this point is
the JLA artist.
The JLA artist from the very beginning, from the Brave and the Bold number 28, and he still is. At this point, Dick Dillon has not taken over yet. So
let's take each of the little villain parts separately.
Okay.
So first off is the Riddler. Hijacks the signal inside the car and, you know, sends him a clue that sends Batman to the famous optometry building. Oh, yes, the optometry building, where there's a giant pair of glasses, and through the glass, Batman sees the diamond exchange and, you know, it finds the Riddler there stealing diamonds, which is just a ploy to get Batman to grab a diamond that's going to explode and dose him with that first chemical. Yeah. So what do you think of this bit?
Yeah, I like it. It's a nice, I mean, it's, you know, Riddler hijacked Batman's TV screen on the Batmobile, which I thought was a nice touch. Haney's got a pretty good, you know, he's got a good handle on the Riddler. This is the first time that I know of that Haney's using the classic Batman rogues. He doesn't get to use them a lot over the course of B&B, the Joker several times. It's usually not the classic rogues because it's, you know, that would make it way too lopsided to be a Batman story versus a spotlight for the other characters. But I like it. I do think the perspective on the bottom panel on page 3 is a little odd. It looks like Batman just climbed like 6 feet to a rooftop. Sikowski's art is often full of strange idiosyncrasies, so it's just kind of par for the course there. But I do like the giant glasses seem to be kind of a nod to that Bill Finger kind of giant prop from, you know, the Golden Age stories, you know, giant typewriters, giant billboards that are, you know, super elaborate. And so Batman looking through these giant glasses seems like a nod back to that.
I especially like, I almost called it my cool move for Batman. Except it's kind of, it turns out to be a mistake, so I didn't use it. But when he grabs that diamond that is thrown out the window, cool reflexes for Batman. And then he like immediately realizes it's going to blow and it's hot, and so he throws it. And throughout this sequence, it's kind of like the Riddler's Joker-ish, where there's a lot of laughing, which is used as a sound effect. Kind of, you know, big laughs, hee hee hee, and you know.
that might have been a little keyed off of Frank Gorshin's manic portrayal of the Riddler.
I think that's what he's doing, right? He's writing these rogues as they are in the show and in the film. So very much a tie-in book to those projects. Next up is the sequence with the Penguin, who's flying around on an umbrella. Yeah, the penguins fly. But there's the City Museum has a bird collection, and I guess they're stuffed birds. This is where he's going to get, you know, Batman dosed with a second chemical. Now, this is a shorter sequence, but the art makes it kind of sing, you know, because there's that moment where Batman is like snapping his fingers. Yes, you know, like it's exactly how the TV show would have the characters come to these conclusions. There's like a snap. Yes, I got it, you know.
Yeah, if Robin was there, he'd be punching his fist into his open palm. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I really like this sequence. I really like Sikowski's take on the Penguin. He always seemed to be, you know, excel at odd-shaped characters. You know, his form of the heroic form was kind of sometimes a little, you know, iconoclastic to the DC House style. Although, you know, on the flip side of that, he was obviously very good at drawing beautiful females because of his Wonder Woman and Supergirl runs. But, you know, I really love that bottom panel on page 6, that picture of the Penguin, like, smugly looking back over his shoulder at Batman with his kind of like his eyes almost closed. That's a great portrait of the Penguin right there. I love it.
I think all his superheroes are sort of basically built on the same model. Kind of boring. I always find like the early Justice League stories kind of a bore because of it. But when it comes to like more grotesque characters, it seems to come alive. And I think the Penguin is a good example of that.
Yeah. And I know even back in the letter columns of the Justice League, there were people writing in that basically said they didn't like the art. Can you replace Mike Sikowski? But, you know, I guess Julius Schwartz felt like he could handle a group, you know, better than just about anybody. And I mean, yeah, there's very few people that could have crammed that many characters into, you know, he drew like 60 some issues of Justice League plus the Brave and the Bold. So, yeah, he was really good at it. So as a kid, when I'd read old reprints, I'd be like, oh, you know, but I've come to appreciate his artwork a lot more. So
I think it's a lot more dynamic in this issue than what I'm used to, I think. You know, later in the 60s, he's also going to be doing some Teen Titans, which I rate. I don't know, maybe it's the really early work that makes me say that. But in this case, it's like the car stuff's really cool. The light is shining out of the headlights, and they're just very dynamic. And so this brings us to the third sequence, which is with the Joker, the craziest sequence. I mean, it's the Joker, so it makes sense. The Joker has somehow replaced the head of the gear shift with his own head that can speak. And Batman, this is a very Haney idea, Batman has a button inside the car for an anti-booby trap circuit. I wouldn't put a button on it. I would just have it be always on,
yeah,
whatever it means. But he pushes the button, and the one thing that isn't booby trap proof is the button itself. And so the booby trap circuit actually releases the third dose and makes Batman, I mean, this is what I mean by the dynamic car stuff, makes Batman crash the car. It really looks cool.
Yeah, yeah. How he didn't, go through the windshield, I don't know. There's no bad airbag that we see, and this is before airbags were popular, obviously. But, yeah, that's a great panel where he's crashing into the pole, and I like how the one passenger side front tire is actually, overlapping the next panel. It's very dynamic. It's it really feels like it just slammed into a solid object, and it's almost coming at us a little bit. You know, that's a neat trick there. Yeah, and I like his take on this, the 1964 Batmobile here that was the new look Batmobile. It would soon be replaced by one that looked more like the TV show version. But yeah, he's got a good handle on it too. Yeah, and the Joker gear shift, he looks creepy. His Joker, we'll get into that later, but his Joker in certain panels looks really creepy, which this is before the Joker generally looked, in this era, the Joker generally did not look creepy, too creepy, you know, so.
We're into part two. Batman becomes the Bat-Hulk. And he's also laughing his head off. So, you know, there's definitely a dose of Smilex in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he realizes he's evil. He's got these powers. He melts his gloves off while he's burning the telephone pole he crashed into. Crosses paths with Commissioner Gordon in a car with another police officer. There's a very weird use of Commissioner Gordon in this, because he's here as of page 10, you know, all through to the end. He's kind of an active participant, but Mike Sikowski doesn't want to draw him.
Yeah, that's true.
You just never really see him. He's either a very tiny figure, or he's a shadow inside a car. We're seeing cops shooting, but he's off panel, that kind of thing. It's a very strange use of Gordon, where on the first read, I didn't even realize he was there.
Yeah, it is. That's true. I mean, the most you see of him in this sequence is you see him over his shoulder and the back of his head, and just the very, very side of his face as he's turning away. He's turning away from the camera. It is odd that we don't have, the Commissioner Gordon. But at this point, he had the little pencil thin mustache and white hair. He didn't have the big bushy white mustache. But yeah, it's odd that you don't see that. And I have no idea why. Maybe he didn't know what Commissioner Gordon looked like. I don't know.
Yeah, it's almost like we need the speech bubble to tell us he's even there.
Right.
It's maybe Sikowski didn't. I know they weren't working at DC. Even Bob Haney wasn't working with the Marvel method.
No.
But it's almost like a Marvel method mistake, where the artist doesn't draw Commissioner Gordon, but the writer wants Commissioner Gordon to be there and just decides that one of the figures inside the car is Commissioner Gordon. But we do see him in a tiny figure where he's not dressed as a beat cop. So I guess he was always there. It's very weird. The Bat-Hulk is going to pull a Marvel Hulk, where he's going to walk into the woods and kind of disappear, turn back into Bruce Wayne or Batman, except he leaves these acid footprints, smoking footprints in the ground. You know, the transformation is on and off, just like the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that about the weird, not like maybe kind of a weird Marvel method kind of goof up, but that the one panel on page 11, it's the third panel where Batman, I guess, is kind of, he's transforming back. It's his moments later deep in the park. He looks like he's turned completely into mist and is going down into the water. There's this red coloring as the steam's coming up out of the water. But then the next panel, Bat-Hulk is looking into the water. And then the very next panel, he changes back to regular Batman. So it's I don't know what that one panel is supposed to be. I guess did he turn into mist to get away, or is this him transforming? I was a little confused by that.
The best I can come up with is that he walked into the water. He's smoking, right? So it's like he walks into the water and steam is rushing over him.
Okay.
As he like boils water. I don't know. It is really odd.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay, I'll go with that.
Now, we need to get Metamorpho into this, right? At some point. So in the next sequence, which I find highly ridiculous, Batman, again, a snap of the fingers. Of course, who knew that Simon Stagg lived in Gotham? But he does. So I don't know. I don't remember it from... It's been too long since I've read the original Metamorpho stories. But I don't remember being it in Gotham City, probably unnamed city.
Yeah.
But Batman decides to go to the mansion and ask Simon Stagg, who's a famous scientist, among other things, for help on this. And probably it's like, well, I've got a chemical reaction thing going. The connection to Metamorpho is probably sound, right? Okay, it makes sense. But what doesn't make sense is Batman crawling on his hands and knees. I mean, we laughed at his hiding under a mule.
Yes.
This is a stealth fail.
Yeah.
Real stealth fail. But he gets easily found by Stagg's creepy fascist henchmen. Which, I mean, they wear hoods and logos and...
Bright purple hoods and bright yellow, like jumpers, and yeah, right. And purple boots.
They're not even trying to stealth.
No, but in your first Metamorpho story, I did go back and reread the first Metamorpho story. I hadn't read them in a while either. He does have hooded guards. They don't wear yellow.
Okay.
But he does have hooded executioner style guards on his property. So this is consistent with the Metamorpho canon, but in case anybody wants a big, giant butt shot of Batman, you know, I know Nightwing's famous for his booty, but, you know, Batman's got back here in this, panel 3 of page 12 right here. So
it's very granny panties kind of.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Yeah. He's got, yeah.
Yeah. Adam West is writing in the whole controversy where, you know, maybe he was taking on weight, but no, it was the stuntman, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, Robin famously, the Catholic League of Decency was like condemning Burt Ward for his bulge in his tights or something. So, yeah, maybe that's what's going on. I don't know. Yeah.
There's not much dignity to this moment.
No.
I say he's like crawling on his hands and knees as if he's... It's just like in between panels where he's kind of, okay, figured it out. He seems pretty energetic. But by the time he gets to the mansion, he needs to be brought into the house by the guards. Like he's drained.
Maybe he walked all the way from Gotham to wherever city Metamorpho's in. I don't know.
With these like strange characters, I always say it's Apex City because there was like, I don't know, Martian Manhunter lived in Apex City or something. It's sort of like a name that fans have given to these kinds of places because they're full of chemical plants.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
And it's like Apex Chemicals or something. So he's super tired anyways. He gets seen by the doctor. We talked about the revelations in the synopsis earlier. It doesn't take a long time for Batman to turn into the Bat-Hulk again. What is he throwing Java into? Like a bath of water or something?
I hope it's not like acid or something. Yeah, it's like, you know, because he's in his laboratory. So, yeah, he picks him up and just hurls him. I do kind of like the weird little panel where I always like that in old comics where the way the artist shows a change, like the
like ghostly. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's like the shadows are just, they're not solid. There's like streaks of lines through them to show that he's transparent and he's turning into the Bat Hulk. That's kind of a neat little effect on the top of page 14, that first panel. So I do think one thing's really weird. One, not weird, but Sikowski probably in Haney's notes in the script he mentioned show his Simon Stagg's pet jaguar Sheba, which is from the series. So we see that there. He keeps trying to call Batman Old Cape and Cal because Rex says Old Cape and Cal himself, you know.
And the narrator does it too.
He keeps trying to make that a new, like, you know, if it had stuck, it might have been Frank Miller might have written Old Cape and Cal Returns. Who knows? I don't know. You know, so.
Yeah, it's not the best. What do you think of this first fight between Batman and or Bat Hulk and Metamorpho?
I like it. It's pretty dynamic. The fact that it's a cool visual for Rex to make his hands into a magnesium mesh net. But then, of course, Batman melts, Bat-Hulk melts them, which is like, oh, did he just melt his hands? You know, he's melting the magnesium like taffy. But then it makes our buddy Max Romero proud and becomes a moldorama. And it actually makes a mold of Metamorpho and then uses that magnesium to create a magnesium duplicate that he tosses at Rex, which somehow is, I guess, semi-animated. It, you know, it wraps itself around him like a Japanese sumo wrestler, as Rex says.
It's sticky. All tangled up in himself, that is like a creepy panel. It works for me as a visual. And he has to turn into acid to get rid of the magnesium. Like, does he absorb it back into himself, this duplicate? Because it was his fingers before.
Right.
I don't know. But the Bat-Hulk escapes and finds the three villains...
somehow.
With his chemical sense tingling.
Yeah.
And then he basically decides, he's doing like finger guns and threatening them with chemicals, gases from his fingertips. And they're sort of forced to follow his plans, his criminal plans.
So that really worked out well for you guys, like you mentioned. Like, good job. Good job, villains. You know, it's like you couldn't just kill him. You had to turn him into a raging monster that could potentially, like, destroy you. So that's good. That's real good thinking.
But yeah. The transformations are coming in more fast and furious as he becomes Batman, normal Batman, again, and is sort of stunned to be surrounded by his greatest foes.
Yes, and that just in time for the chapter break in the little half-page ad at the bottom of that page, too. So,
and as we come back from the commercial... he becomes Bat-Hulk again. It was hardly worth the cliffhanger. You know?
Maybe that was Haney trying to do the, you know, Batman aired two days a week originally during seasons one and two. Maybe that was him trying to do the death trap cliffhanger there, you know, but I don't know.
No, I like it.
I love the Joker's face on page 18. That, I know he's like scared, but that is one demented looking Joker right there. It's just the hollowed out eyes. It just, it's like, wow, that's creepy.
What I like about that page is the topmost panel where the shadows of the villains are sort of, you know, like leaving us a print on Batman who is in the light.
Mm, it kind of reminds me of the animated opening where the villains are like just scrolling across the scene coming toward Batman and Robin. And then you see them flying after the pals and the, you know, they fly, they punch them off screen and they fly at them. And it kind of looks like some of them are up close. Like you see the Joker, Catwoman, and some of them. And then you see like just some silhouettes of other guys. That's what it kind of reminds me of.
I want to talk about that panel at the bottom. First of all, Metamorpho is not allowed in the car. Has to ride on the top. And there's room. I mean, there are only three in the car.
I mean, Java takes up a huge amount of room, but yeah, there's enough room and you can still see there's... Maybe Rex didn't want to sit next to Java. Maybe that, because they don't like each other, obviously. Yeah, so...
Like a shapeshifter could fit in even in a full car.
Right.
So he's like riding the top and like knocking on the top. Okay, let's stop here. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is, of course, the Flying Batcave. What is it called?
The Flying Batcave, which is a real comic... thing. If this is an obscure callback to a Golden Age item not seen in years by this point, it debuted in Detective Comics number 186, August 1952. So it is actually, it's not something Haney made up. He pulled it out of bat lore.
Wow. But I also have to question it, because if you have a vehicle called the Flying Batcave, you are just signaling to your enemies that your HQ is in a cave somewhere.
True. I think at that point, though, I think that everybody knew Batman had a bat cave, because there's always, whenever he takes somebody, especially on the TV show, like I know at one point he has to take Commissioner Gordon down there. He's like, this is the fabulous bat cave. You know, of course, he bat gasses him and bat wakes him back up, you know, so he doesn't know where it's at. But, and I think in the comics, there'd been a couple stories where Batman allowed people to, like, I think there might have been one where they filmed inside the Batcave. Of course, he had to take them there blindfolded or something. So it's like he advertised he had a Batcave, which isn't real smart, but you know. So.
At the same time, it's part of the brand because bats live in caves. So
right,
you could take it as that.
Right.
It's still a strange name for a vehicle.
Yes. Could just be a big Batcopter, you know, yeah.
What Batman does here, Bat-Hulk, he's using his chemical powers to... break into the bank, steal a bunch of bags of money, tie them up to a cable, which the villains inside the Flying Batcave reel in. But as soon as the police helicopters show up, they ditch the Bat Hulk.
Imagine that.
When Bat Hulk crawls out of the hole, pretty high, I guess he can jump, he's Hulkish, he has to face Metamorpho once again. So, second fight with Metamorpho.
Yeah, this is more like the cover image, although the villains, of course, aren't there. We even get a panel at the bottom of page 20, which is essentially the cover image. I do like that Batman, like I said, he throws a batarang. Of course, Metamorpho can't just say, he has to say what he's doing. Better make with a potassium detour, I'll catch it in the neck. You know, which he's, I like how this was, George Kasdan is the editor here as well. So maybe he's, you know, leaving.
Metamorpho's head is made of potassium.
Right, exactly. I see there's a little note beside there that says silver white next to that panel. I wonder if that was like a, maybe that was the indication for the colorist to color Metamorpho's head silver white. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't have that note.
Oh, okay. It's in the, this is on DC Universe Infinite. I don't have the original. Okay. So
interesting. I have the scan. Well, obviously the original would be a bit costly. Yeah. I have a scan that has all the ads.
Oh, cool.
So it doesn't have that notation. That's interesting that the DC Infinite brought out some of the notes from the original art. They used like the original art to produce these.
Yeah, this one looks like it's just scanned from a really good copy. It doesn't look like it's recolored because it's got the dots, you know, here and there, you can see them. And so honestly, I'd prefer they just do that because some of the things they do on DC Universe Infinite are really head scratching how they present. It's very super, super, super inconsistent. But
yeah, I don't like modern coloring on older comics. They were just not drawn for it.
No.
And, you know, I'd rather have some like weird bleeds where the you know, the color doesn't actually match the line work, that kind of thing. I prefer that. Obviously, we're old school. Fun little fight where Metamorpho is quickly trounced, squeezed into powerlessness. I guess like he's like part of him is coming down. No, both of him, I guess, are coming down drains. They're
yeah.
They're going to dug like gutters, rain gutters, and it's washing out from two ends. He's not even like in one piece. It's like there's one piece coming down one pipe and another piece coming down the other.
Yeah. All the humility, you know.
There's not much dignity for him either. Like, you know, you can't ride in the car stuff. And Stagg has this notion, this theory, that if you zap powerless Metamorpho with electricity, it's going to snap him back together, fully rejuvenated.
That checks, you know.
And it works, you know, it works. But the sure. Bat-Hulk has escaped again. And this time, they know where the Bat-Hulk is going to be because Commissioner Gordon, behind the scenes, has modified the Bat-Signal and is shooting it towards in the sky, but over the place where Bat-Hulk has been spotted.
Because that's how the Bat-Signal works, too, that it can just point it wherever, too, you know. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully, it's cloudy and dark, as usual in Gotham, so that the signal works at all.
Yeah.
But it's been modified to be like the silhouette of the Bat-Hulk.
This blob. Just
a big fat Batman.
Yeah, big fat Batman. It just looks kind of like an amorphous blob, honestly. Yeah, it kind of looks like the shape of the Bat-Hulk, but yeah, in the first panel, the second one, it doesn't. It looks like somebody does it, like somebody started to draw the bat signal and scribbled it out. That's what it kind of looks like.
Yeah, Metamorpho and his supporting cast drive over there. Again, Metamorpho is not sitting on the top of the car. He's a gas attached to the car. So I think this works better.
Yes.
It's less humiliating. And he, as a gas, flies up to Batman, who is at the clock tower, sort of twisting the hands of the clock. I don't know what his plan necessarily is here, but they have a third fight on top of the clock tower. Notes on this one, because it's going to end with a Deus Ex Machina in this case. Literally, the lightning from the sky. You know, Zeus takes a hand.
Yeah, I guess this is kind of his King Kong moment, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is, that's the only thing I can figure. I don't know what Batman, I mean, how does this fit into his crime spree that he's just going to go climb this clock tower? It didn't really make a lot of sense, or Bat-Hulk, sorry. But the ending, my original, when I reread this, I thought, when we got to the scene where Simon has Java, you know, zap Rex and bring his body back together, I thought that Rex was going to do something to draw electricity to Batman. But no, it's just Batman picks up what he thinks is an antenna, but it's a lightning rod, and it, you know, shocks Bat-Hulk, and Rex doesn't do anything. So it's just like he turns his lower into a spring and confronts him, and then Batman picks up the pole and then zap. Fuzzap!
If at least Metamorpho had tricked him into using the lightning rod, or he could have been a lightning rod, you know, be the element that draws in like an aluminum stick or something, you know, something.
Right. Or the wires up around the rod that we see in that one panel, if he changed his arm into that and drew it down or something,
just happens and somehow resolves the situation, burns the chemicals out of Batman. No, you're right, because it seems like there's this foreshadowing of this solution. It is a solution, but it's accidental.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And then, I mean, then we skip to downstairs to the street where, again, Commissioner Gordon is seen from the back, and you have to know it's him. The three crooks have been arrested?
Yep. They're just leaning up against the building, just kind of put out. They're not in handcuffs. There's no cops with guns at them, and the Penguin still has his umbrella in his hand. I mean, he still has his weapon, you know, and they're just Simon, Gordon, one cop, and Sapphire just standing around. I mean, these guys couldn't take out these people. You know, they're like three of the worst criminals, the three greatest criminals in Batman's rogues gallery, minus maybe Catwoman and Two-Face. And they couldn't take out these people with no weapons trained on them, you know?
Right. I mean, at the top of the chapter, we were led to believe that they were a threat to Batman.
Right.
Like, Batman's like, oh, no, I'm surrounded by these three. Like, he's in trouble. And then these three are surrounded by complete civilians, including an old man.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to think that they just give up.
Yeah.
So it doesn't quite track, but I mean, we're at the end of the issue. We gotta wrap this up, folks.
Right.
So
right. We don't even get the full last page because we got room for an ad at the bottom. So yeah, we got it. Yeah,
right. Whatever. Well, you know, Barry Allen's getting married.
Oh, is that what it's for?
It's Professor Ira West invites you to attend the marriage of his daughter Iris to Barry Allen.
November
issue of The Flash.
Nice.
If I ever get married, I want to do this on my invitation.
There you go.
In a November issue. I want to declare what my secret identity is on my civilian invitation.
There you go.
So we're at the last page. Batman is on Metamorpho's shoulder. Again, butt shot, no dignity to this. And the villains are laughing. Is he dead? Haha, Batman's dead. You know, they think they've won in some way. Their laughter wakes Batman, who still on the shoulder is, you know, like, gives him some shit. And they're carried off as Metamorpho says, well, Batman, I'll see you on the TV, pal. So it's like they know the TV series is real within the comics. And it's, we've seen it on covers where, you know, Batman's watching his own show. So that's canon.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because I thought that and Sapphire, when she first met, it's like, oh, I watch you every week on TV. But I looked up Batman number 183 is that famous cover where Robin's answering the hotline. It's like, come on, Batman, we got to go. And Batman's loafing like, oh, I'm watching myself on TV, you know. And it's just like the adventures of Batman on the TV screen. But within that story, because I just looked it up this morning, and I've read it before, but, you know, it's been years. Actually, it's a documentary on Batman that's on TV. So this comic is saying the Batman, the 1966 20th Century Fox Greenway Productions Batman TV series exists within the DC Universe, or Bob Hades Earth B version of the DC Universe.
As a documentary.
No, I don't know. I think this one, they say it's every week. So I think the actual Batman TV series in this comic exists in the DC Universe.
Docuseries.
I don't know. Maybe it's just somebody,
how to catch a super murderer.
I don't. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's ahead of the curve with all that. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, it's very meta. Very meta before there was meta. Yeah.
The end. And we'll be seeing more of DC's team ups with Fabulous Heroes. But at this point, it's not necessarily a Batman series, Brave and the Bold. So they kind of switch it up. Almost the end, if you have the original issue or the scan as I have, there is a text page after this, which is called Strange Transformations. And they use the Metamorpho and Batman as Bat-Hulk transformation to talk about transformations in myth and literature.
Okay.
Whether it's like in the Odyssey, or I think it ends with Jekyll and Hyde, and they talk about different transformations and shapeshifters in myth and literature. So interesting. This is still the era where we need to include a text page.
Yeah.
And it's not a letters page. So it's kind of informational. That's kind of cool. It has nothing to do with anything except the theme of the issue, so I at least appreciate that. It's not like a random collection of trivia or anything.
Oh, that's cool. That's obviously not on DC Universe Infinite, so.
Final thoughts before we head into the categories?
This is fun. This is kind of a notorious comic as it's one of the campier issues to come out in the height of the Batmania around the TV show. I mean, of course, the TV show was a humongous success. It caught everybody by surprise how huge it was. It was a mid-season replacement, debuted in January of 66 and exploded in popularity. Batman merchandise was everywhere. It's really where the Batman merchandising machine began. There was very little merchandise before the TV show propelled all that. Of course, all the celebrities wanted parts on the TV show, and so that's why they were cast as villains after it took off so much. And they started doing things like the cameo bat climbs, including Jerry Lewis, who appeared in a bat climb, but also in his comic, the DC Comics, The Adventures of Jerry Lewis, number 97, a very super campy issue where he meets Batman and Robin and the Joker. And that actually, the two of these are actually basically usually pulled out to see this is how crazy DC Comics went when the popularity of Batman like really kicked in for them. And the camp elements did kind of leak into the Julia Schwartz edited comics, not quite as much. I mean, Batman fought some really dopey villains like the Eraser and things like that, but it didn't last as long in the comics as you would think it did. Although there was a need to, you know, go back to the roots of the Creature of the Night and kind of expunge the taint of the campiness after that fell out of favor in the TV. Of course, the TV show burned bright, but burned out quickly. It was canceled by 1968. So there you go.
And certainly the spirit of this type of Batman team-up lived on or resurrected in the Brave and the Bold cartoon series, which is much more like in this mold, even like the clean art. It's kind of, I don't know, reminiscent of this. I had like a flash of memory. Like the first time I ever read this story, it was black and white in the Showcase Presents collection. Mm-hmm. And so I assumed the Bat Hulk was green.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So here he's not green. So so they didn't push it as far as that. You know,
yeah.
At the same time, I mean, late 60s, they were doing like in their humor comics, whether like Inferior Five or whatever, you would have Marvel characters just showing up.
Yeah.
Spoof of themselves, but still being kind of themselves. Or it was more porous or less litigious maybe at that point. All right. Let's look at our categories. Who fared better, Chris? Is this a Batman story or is it more of a Metamorpho story? Because, I mean, the kookiness is very Metamorpho, but I have to admit, he's hardly in this.
Honestly, I think if you remove Rex and his cast from the story, it's really not any different. They didn't cure Batman. Fate did. So it's more of a Batman story, but a very campy one, even for 1966. So I will, you know, it's kind of like that old, well, if you take Indiana Jones out of Raiders, then it doesn't really change any. The story doesn't change. It's like, well, if you take Rex and Simon and all them out, it doesn't really change the story any. So I think this is more of a Batman story, just a very bizarre one.
Someone could argue that he's got chemical powers because Metamorpho is chemical. It's like a Metamorpho story starring Batman in a weird way. But it's his villains. It's obviously promoting his movie. And Metamorpho doesn't fix anything. He just shows up to fight the Bat Hulk a couple times. So he's kind of the hero of the piece and Batman is the villain. It's still in the Batman universe. Here's a question that we only asked for the Brave and Bold segment. Do they know Batman's secret identity? Does Metamorpho know or eventually know?
He doesn't know yet, but apparently he will, because this is the reason this segment exists. In The Brave and the Bold, number 123, December 1975, Rex hears of Bruce Wayne being in jail. Of course, he's falsely accused. And in disguise, Rex frees him and brings him his Batman costume, meaning at some point, Rex learned Bruce Wayne was Batman. And Batman and the Outsiders, writer Mike W. Barr established that none of the team initially knew Batman's secret identity. When later writers pointed out that the Brave and the Bold stories written by Bob Haney said, yes, he did, Barr flatly denied this, saying those stories had to be out of continuity. The debate raged on in the letter column for months. Thus, our running gag feature about the guest star knowing Batman's secret identity.
There you go. A peek behind the curtain. Why we even do this? It's because Bob Haney's stories, like the so-called Earth B, or B minus, or whatever it's called. The details aren't always the same. All right, let's talk about cool moves. What is Batman's coolest move, in your opinion?
Like I said, I really like that Moldorama moment where he makes like the mold and sends that weird kind of bizarre metamorpho copy after Rex. I think that's it's out of left field, but it's a cool move.
I like the toothpaste moment myself, which is on the cover and interior. But that's all Bat Hulk, what we're talking about here. So as Batman himself, I have to say he does pretty poorly in this. So I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. There is a category for bad moves. So let's just talk about Metamorpho's coolest move.
I think making his hands into a net to try and contain Bat Hulk, even though it doesn't work, it's a cool visual.
I think you're right. Otherwise, he's mostly dodging the Bat Hulk's attacks the whole issue. There isn't much to look at here. Dumb or weird moves, Batman's?
I think, honestly, blindly trusting Simon Stagg. I mean, I know Bruce is a fellow one percenter, but he should smell his seediness from a mile away. Come on. I mean,
he seeks him out.
Yeah, it's like he couldn't go to, why didn't he go to somebody like, Will Magnus or somebody like that, or somebody or Professor Nichols or, somebody, not freaking Simon Stagg. Yeah.
There's plenty to choose from in terms of Batman's bad moves. The villains escape him, his anti-booby trap button backfires, he crashes the Batmobile, he lets lightning zap him. Still, I think I'm going to go with the undignified stealth approach to Stagg's mansion. Just go to the front door, buddy.
Yeah.
What about Metamorpho?
Letting Bat Hulk get his hands on him? I mean, he could remain fluid the entire time they're fighting, or gaseous or something, yeah. So.
Oh, yeah, or gaseous. Like, choke him out. Use a gas to choke him out. But letting himself be tangled by the dummy of himself, I think, is particularly bad. I know it feels kind of animated, but at the same time, not. It's just very weird. I don't even know how it works. The dummy is made of a material that was the fingers, so it's himself, but he needs to destroy it by turning into acid rather than reabsorb it. And what, he can't just like stand up and free himself from that stiff dummy or turn into a gas at that point and get, from out from under the weird body? It's just a weird moment just to let the Bat Hulk escape. I think Metamorpho is like tougher and more versatile than that.
Yeah, and it's maybe this is where Shift comes from. I don't know,
And then there's the friendly farewell. What do we think of this one? Do we see how Rex will become a member of Batman's team when the need arises? Is there already a connection, you think?
I mean, it's very friendly. I think Batman gives Rex a bit too much credit for saving his bacon, because it's basically just, random fate that almighty power of some kind that stops the Bat Hulk. But maybe this is why Batman puts him on the speed dial for the outsiders. Yeah.
Yeah, although outsiders are like formed by, they all showed up at the same place.
Right, that's
randomly.
True. Yeah.
Although maybe Rex was working with Batman, is one of the ones that was working with Batman. I'm trying to remember.
Okay, it's been so long since I read it, I don't remember, yeah.
Final question. If this were your first Metamorpho story, would you seek out more?
Well, maybe for the quirky cast, including Rex and Simon and Sapphire and Java, but, Haney and Editor Cashton really didn't do their co-creation favors by not having him save the day here. He's just kind of there running interference until nature takes its course. So it's not the greatest showcase for him. I thought they would have made him come out on top, because this is their boy, So.
It's their boy, and he gets to be the hero where Batman is a threat.
Yeah.
So it should have been his, I don't know. Yeah, I agree, but all the elements are there, so to speak. All the elements are there. The transformations, the supporting cast is with him the whole way through. Like, you feel like you're in a Metamorpho comic in a way. So based on that, I think I would want to see Metamorpho in his own, again, I'm not doing this on purpose, but in his own element, where we don't have Batman to worry about, and it's just them and their banter and their adventures. I think it's kind of there. Maybe I would. All right. We'll take a break for a couple promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
Return to the House of Frankenstein and enter its horror hall of fame.
Four fright-filled films featuring the legends of terror.
Vincent Price.
I'm going to give the people what they want. Sensation, horror, shock.
Lon Chaney Jr.
I brought that wonderful surprise I promised you.
Peter Cushing.
I know that strange, devilish forces do exist with powers beyond the comprehension of mere mortal man.
Christopher Lee.
Burn, witch, burn, witch, burn, burn, burn.
plus your favorite superheroes battle macabre menaces.
The Fantastic Four.
The Phantom Stranger.
The Teen Titans.
And Superman.
Tell me where they are, I'll break every bone in your body.
Visit fireandwaterpodcast.com in September and October as the Supermates Podcast returns for its terrifying 13th season at the House of Frankenstein.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, they said Metahawk was too much like Dark Claw. Dark Claw, whose comics outsell everything else on the stands. Dark Claw, whose sustained popularity packs in comic stores and theaters alike. Too much like Dark Claw? You better believe it. Metahawk is exactly like Dark Claw, and if you can't get more Dark Claw, then you should totally buy Metahawk number 1. On the stand soon with 20 alternate collector covers. Order it now, nerds. Only from Amalgam Comics. We're back, and our monthly feature is the bonus team-up in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect Metamorpho team-up.
I'm going to propose Metamorpho and Swamp Thing. I think that would have been a great team-up, especially back in the 70s before when Swamp Thing actually was Alec Holland transformed before he was just the consciousness of, you know, or whatever, based on Alec Holland before the anatomy lesson. Toward the end of the Swamp Thing run, they were going to try to cram Hawkman in there as the hero to, for some reason. I think Metamorpho would have made a lot more sense. You could have got Simon Stagg involved trying to get the biorestorative formula for himself and, you know, Rex, of course, sympathizing with Alec, and they could have made a good, like, freaky buddy cop team, you know, in the comic. And I think it would have worked. And Rex wasn't doing anything during this period at all. He was pretty fallow, so he wasn't in hardly any comics other than the occasional team up. So, you know, they could have moved the whole, you know, maybe even Simon Stagg could have been involved with the you know, the conclave that was out to destroy the biorestorative formula or whatever, you know, the whole, what was the guy's name that Swamp Thing went to Gotham and met, encountered Batman, and the guy got killed. No, I can't think of it, but, you know, Simon Stagg could have been involved in all that and tied them together or something. I think it would have been pretty cool.
Even later, I mean, we got the Element Man and then the Plant Elemental version.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's certainly a connection between them. And I also went with another DC property instead of going to another company's, which we sometimes do. I'm going with Metamorpho and Rex the Wonder Dog. It's dumb. It's silly. It's two Rexes for the price of one. And let's make that 3. They're going to fight a T-Rex from the Cretaceous. I mean, it's not like it hasn't happened to the Wonder Dog, because judging from later covers of the series, there's stuff like that going on. You know, Rex versus a dinosaur. So yeah, that's my idea, where Metamorpho, you know, gets a pet.
Nice. This might be an indexing show, but it's going to jump around as inspired by the issue we're looking at now. So every episode will explain the thematic logic between this episode's guest star and the next. So Siskoid, where to now and how do you get us there?
Yes, who is Brave and Bold next? We're going to go with Brave and the Bold number 146. So you have time to track it down. Batman and the Unknown Soldier. Connection is spurious, but both Metamorpho and the Unknown Soldier have chalk white faces, feel deformed, and both are shapeshifters, although the soldier does it with makeup and masks and stuff. So that's my idea for another unconventional, probably, team up between Batman and a World War II hero. So that's what we're going to do next.
Nice. Yes, I have that issue, so I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Brave and the Bold number 119, starring Batman and Man-Bat.
Okay, our pal Rob Kelly says, I've always loved Man-Bat. Like Chris, I'm pretty sure my first exposure to him was the Power Record. It was about as a powerful intro into a character as a kid can have. While the Batman family stories were fun, I think he works better as Spice. So him showing up every so often in B&B is perfect. In an alternate world, Marvel beat DC to the punch and created Man-Bat first so he could be part of the Legion of Monsters. That's the same world where DC created a Spider-Woman and Charlton published the Super Friends comic. Yes, true. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Ange says, I also find Batman to be sort of mean in this issue. Funny, especially with the Bale voice. It's all you. As for Man-Bat, for some reason, he just appeals to me, so I am always willing to give his stories a try. Look at my collection, and I have his 70s series, the Delano Prestige one, the Battle of the Cowl issue, and that the only issue I have of that, etc. In particular, I love that Secret Origins issue and found the explanation of the bat flying through the window a perfect no problem. surprise to explain why a bat would fly through glass to begin with. Heck, I even got Nolan to sign it at a con and gushed on the art. Batman hiding under the mule reminded me of Odysseus and his men hiding under sheep in a similar fashion to escape the Cyclops cave. Very timely reference, given what's in the movies right now.
Yes, that's true. Gothos Mansion writes in, I think the amount of story crammed into Bronze Age comics is why I have a hard time with the glacial right for the trade pacing of modern comics. Bob Haney crammed more into his stories than most Bronze Age writers. Can you believe that bit with Batman and the shark only got a page? Most writers would have stretched that out into at least a 3 or 4 page action sequence. I think most writers would have treated Batman turning into a man Batman as a plot for an entire issue, but it's almost a throwaway here in Haney's script. Haney went back to the well with a Bat Batman in B&B 137, which I thought you might segue into next. Bat-Hulk is fun, though.
Yeah, that's too easy.
Yeah, right, right.
Rob McCarthy's team-up is Man-Bat and Riddler as private detectives, but he's not sure what the plot would be. Bucky 749 here takes to the IDW universe and has Man-Bat and his family save a little mutant Batgirl named Barbara, and the Man-Bat family can go on adventures with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and little Barbara to save Venus from Baxter Stockman that will make an Elseworlds as they adopted Barbara, the girl mutant, and move to Mutant Town. Since the whole family is mutants, happy ending. I mean, you lost me somewhere in there, but I'm sure it makes sense to someone. And then Hal offers Man-Bat and Spawn trying to save Vampyra. And then Nate the Great, Man-Bat and Ghost Rider against Dracula and the Lizard.
I'd buy that. Ward Hill Terry writes in, one of the main things with many of Haney's B&B stories is to realize that he was writing contemporary movies with superheroes in the lead roles. Look back over the previous 12 months from almost any Haney story from this era, and you may spot the cinematic and TV influence. He may have anticipated the movie Jaws, but the book was a huge hit in 1974. Caribbean Island with Voodoo Practice, James Bond was at one the year before. Black Napoleon, Haney may have seen or may have only seen an ad for The Black Godfather, released in September of 74. Tough guys as leading men, Clint Eastwood in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, Charles Bronson in Death Wish, and Warren Oates in Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia were on the screen all summer in 1974. Yeah, Haney was probably absorbing the entertainment he was taking in, and obviously he absorbed Batman 66 quite a bit in this issue. So.
Yeah, no, definitely. He wrote so many comics. He was just like a meat grinder for pop culture, and is just like spewing it out in a superhero form. Tim Price says, I first saw Man-Bat in Batman 30s to the 70s, and I've always liked his look. My preference is hero or anti-hero Man-Bat, since it makes for more interesting stories, making a scary character the star. Having him be just another monster just doesn't appeal. There's also something delightfully off-putting by using man as a prefix on a name. It must be from the frequent use of man as suffix for superheroes or even the occasional monster like Universal's Wolfman. But when it starts with man, it accentuates the wrongness of any character, be they Man-Bat, Man-Thing, or Man-Wolf.
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought of that. Yeah. Paul Keehan from this very network writes in, another awesome episode. Poor Man-Bat. He's had so many incarnations and swaps between villain and hero that it's like a yo-yo. He was back to a villain in the relatively recent Batman and Robin series, which I enjoyed. I'm on the fence. With apologies to my podcast partner, Sean M. Myers, who loves him some Detective Man-Bat, I like him both as a hero and a villain. He is fun as a hero as a counterpoint to Batman, and those PI stories with Jason Bard are great. But as a villain, he can certainly be scary, or for all the reasons you cited, including the visceral human reaction to bats.
Little Russell Burbage says Man-Bat is one of my all-time favorite characters, but I'm glad I didn't come across him for the first time in this story, because as both of you point out, he doesn't do a very good job. My favorite Man-Bat is his series in Batman Family. He had Francine, his daughter Rebecca, his pal Jason Bard, and some fun adventures. His team up with the Demon with art by Michael Golden is awesome.
It is indeed awesome. And he is very scary as drawn by Michael Golden, even though he's the hero in that story, because Michael Golden can't draw a non-scary looking monster character. John Stibe, who has guested a lot on this network lately and is a great guy. This was a fun episode to listen to, but I'm late in commenting. There's a reason for that. I've been diving into the Bat catalog of Batman Family Reunion from Paul Keehan and Sean Myers because I've had more time to listen to podcasts due to recent events at home. There is so much Man Bat in those episodes, thanks in part to Sean's love for the character, that by this point, I can't remember which version of Kirk Langstrom I like the most. The hero, the misunderstood villain, the PI, the tragic monster, and there's probably more to come. All I know is I am experiencing more Man Bat in 2026 than I ever did as a kid reading DC Comics. Thanks to everyone involved for making me much more curious about the character, including our two hosts for this episode. Very fun. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying Batman Family Reunion, and I can't recommend that show enough. If you folks haven't listened, it's a great show that Paul and Sean did, and it was a wonderful journey they took us on with that comic.
It's only recently wrapped up, really. Well, thanks for teaming up with me, Chris. Tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Well, you can hear me talk about modern and classic Batman comics every month with our pal Ryan Daly on Batman Nightcast. As we record this, a new installment of Mr. and Mrs. Superman over on the Justice Society Presents feed should be dropping in the next few weeks. And Cindy and I are also working on our 13th annual House of Frankenstein series over on our original Supermates podcast, which will run through September and October as we enter the most wonderful time of the year, spooky season.
Mm-hmm. A reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content, want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. And we do enjoy reading your thoughts. The best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Chris is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Ryan Daly as we continue his coverage of Marvel 2-in-1 with issue 34 of that title. On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.